want to make sure that you are all aware of the fact that this church has a part in the things that I was sharing with you last session, because there have been some prayers and some support from this church that makes some of those things possible. And I thank you for that in the Lord's name. Now, would you take your Bibles and open them up? How appropriate the music. And Daniel 2 is where I want to go. And that's what we sang about. I didn't plan it. You guys didn't plan it either, so don't get cocky. God planned it. And how wonderful is his sovereignty. I'm going to put it into Jewish overdrive. Most of you are not old enough to know what overdrive is. How many of you know what overdrive was? Okay, a few of you. Remnants, the classy remnant. What I mean when I say I'm going to put it into Jewish overdrive is I've got to go quickly, because I was really long last session, and I apologize for that. So Daniel chapter 2, and we'll share a few things that I think are relevant with regard to what is happening over in the Middle East. If I had time, I would suggest to you all over the world, but particularly over in the Middle East, and of course with the central being Israel. That comes right off the pages of the prophetic scriptures, many places. I want to call your attention to Daniel chapter 2 about some of the things that are happening, and I think could explode onto the front pages of the newspapers of the world in actuality, possibly before the end of this year. I guess what I'm saying is, you want to know what's going to happen, you'll get better, more accurate, certainly, information from the scriptures than you will from the magazine, the newspaper, even Fox News. Turn to the prophetic scriptures, because we're living that close to the climactic events of history that the Bible, concerning which the Bible has a lot to say. At any rate, in Daniel chapter 2, this is quick, skeletal. Nebuchadnezzar, who was the most powerful man of the world at that time. And the reason he was the most powerful man in the world, and I remind you, and particularly as we have an election coming up this year and congressional seats, and we were saturated last night with South Carolina, what was going on there. I remind you, as I remind myself, that it is our God who puts kings into power, and he takes kings out of power, and he does so for his purposes. And here is a guy called Nebuchadnezzar, who was the most powerful man in the world of that day, quite literally. There were two superpowers. One at that time, 700 B.C., there were two empires. One was Egyptian and the other was Babylonian. And they were vying for who was going to be the superpower and have most control and most territory. And at the headwaters of the Euphrates River, a place called Carchemish, there was a battle where the Egyptian army of crown prince, not yet king, Nebuchadnezzar, and the Egyptian army fought, and the Babylonian army defeated the Egyptian army, and the Egyptian army had to lick its wounds and head back through Israel to Egypt, defeated. And now there was one ultimate superpower. It was Babylon. And since Nebuchadnezzar realized that there was a vacuum in the area that you would know today as Syria and Lebanon and Israel and Gaza, that whole region had been under the influence of Egypt. But when at Carchemish the Babylonians defeated the Egyptians and they had to go back home licking their wounds, there was a vacuum in that area. Who was going to control it or influence it? And so Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon rushed down. We know this from history. He said, I'm going to fill that vacuum since we beat the Egyptians. And he was there for a short while, only a short while, a matter of weeks. And he received word that his father, who was the king of Babylon at that time, had died. And so Nebuchadnezzar understood for political reasons he had to rush home. And so he didn't take his whole army. He had to get back quick. So he took some soldiers, enough, and supplies, and some of the items from the temple, the gold and silver and so forth, and some young men. This was typical. When one army would defeat another country's army, they would take some of the young men back to their homeland in those days. Number one, it was just good policy, because if the defeated army decided they were going to visit you one day down the road, you got their kids there, and their lives would be in danger if you try to attack us. Plus, usually the noble and royal kids were the brightest, best training, the best education. Therefore, we could train them to become leaders in our government. So it was good policy. So as Nebuchadnezzar rushes back to Babylon because his father had died, he takes some of the nobles, royal noble kids, usually teenagers, between 15 to 18, usually, history tells us. And that included Daniel and his three friends. There have been some others, back to train. And one of the reasons why this was happening to Israel, because God had made a covenant with King David of the tribe of Judah. And God said to David, I will never take the throne away from your family, your lineage, as I did Saul, because he was from the tribe of... What tribe? Right. And when Saul died, his son doesn't become the next king. He switches from Benjamin to Judah. And now God is reassuring David. He says, I will never do that again. It will stay within your family. Your sons, your descendants will prosper forever in the Davidic covenant. Forever sitting upon the throne of Israel. Now he says, now if your descendants, the kings, if they sin, if they're disobedient, I'll punish them. They may go into captivity. Their army may be defeated. They may experience famine. If they sin, they'll be punished. But I will never take, because ultimately, Matthew 1:1, the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of Abraham, the son of David. Because the seed is supposed to come through the Davidic lineage. Well, if you read about the kings before the Babylonian captivity, you will find the last four were evil, 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 evil. So God said, okay, I will punish, 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 punish. And so verses 1 and 2 of chapter 1 says it was God who gave them over to the Babylonians. It wasn't because of their great army. It's because God was doing this in fulfillment of his Davidic covenant. Now it won't be the end of the Davidic lineage, because your descendants will prosper forever. Eventually the Messiah will come. But in the interim, there's going to be some difficult days. So now we're in Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and it's of this statue, this image. Impressive. The Bible says that. It's impressive. It evidently glows. It's made out of some precious materials. It's, I would use the word awesome, magnificent, but in a fearful kind of a way is what the Hebrew text is saying. And you know the story. Nebuchadnezzar has this dream about this image. it troubles him, it disturbs him. He knows that it's important, but he doesn't know what the meaning of it is, so he asks for his magicians, his sorcerers, the Chaldeans, the priest, all of the advisors. He says, tell me the dream, tell me the interpretation of him, can. And eventually, David, remember, had been brought back with Nebuchadnezzar. He was going through this training, a couple of years of training, and now he comes. And he says, I can tell you the dream. After he sought direction from God and prayed about it, he said, I can tell you the dream, and I can tell you the interpretation of it. He said, you saw this image. It had a head of gold. It had a chest and arms of silver. It had a belly of bronze. You had with thighs. You had legs of iron. You had the feet of composites of iron and clay. Strong from the iron, weak from the clay. They didn't adhere very well. But it's interesting, if one reflects upon it, as you come down the image from the head to the feet, it's diminishing in value. The head is gold. Underneath it, chest and arms are silver, not as valuable as gold. And beneath the silver is the brass, bronze, not as valuable as the silver. And below the bronze is the iron, which is not as valuable as the bronze. So it's diminishing as it goes down in value. But interestingly enough, is also as it comes down, it is increasing in strength. Because silver is stronger than gold. And the bronze is stronger than the silver. And the iron is stronger than the bronze. Now, I'm saying this quickly. This is talking about the course of the nations of the world. Literally, the Hebrew is talking about the Goyim or the Gentiles or the Gentile nations. And it's in contrast to the nation of Israel. There's a reason for that. I don't have time to develop it. But it's such an important theme. God had promised in the garden that the seed of the woman would bruise the serpent's head. So Satan tries to corrupt the righteous lineage. So Abel will be slain by Cain. And then there'll be Seth, and they take care of that. And then there'll be the sons of God, so the daughters of men. It's an attempt, without going into the details of who they are, to corrupt the human race so the seed of the woman can't come. And things get so bad that God has to destroy the world by a universal flood. And then there is... 8 souls who lived through that. Noah, his wife, 3 sons, 3 daughters-in-law. On the other side, they begin to repopulate the earth. And then there's a guy by the name of Nimrod. Genesis 10, 11. Bad, 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 bad. Trying to build the Tower of Babel, the city of Babylon. That all had to do with the establishment of a one-world government. Globalism. Don't think that's new. And a one-world religion. The worship of the heavenly bodies. That's what the Tower of Babel is all about. Get high so we can look and worship. And God has to go down and scatter them because they had one language. They're trying to establish a one world government under Satan and a one world religion, which would be the worship of Satan. This takes you back to Genesis 3. The seed of the woman is going to bruise his head. He wants to rule. And there's a virus. The nations are scattered. People are scattered. You've got the nations. All of them are idolatrous. Look at the history books. Anyone you want to pick up. Look at Egypt. Look at Assyria. Babylon. Medo-Persia. Greece. Rome. or the hundreds of other nations, you'll find one thing in common, every single one of them. There's no debate, no theological discussion. Idol, idolatrous, 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 idolatrous. They had a virus of idolatry. That's why God said, I got to establish a new nation that doesn't have that virus. In the next chapter, chapter 12, God brings a new nation into existence through Abraham. Not because he deserved it or the people that would come from him deserved it, because God in sovereignty is trying to provide salvation for multitudes who have a virus. And the entire Old Testament is talking about, this is not oversimplification, of a new nation. Abraham, in thee and in thy seed shall all the nations of the world be blessed. That is the potentiality for life and the goodness of God upon that life. And the entire Old Testament is the account of a woman who is in travail to give birth to the seed. And God gave them a law and gave them prophets, gave them priests, gave them kings, and said through that king's lineage, the seed of the woman that will bruise the serpent's head, recapture man's lost destiny of the king of the earth, will come. But when you come to Babylon and the statue of Daniel chapter 2, that's talking about the course of the Gentiles or of the nations apart from the nation of Israel, because through that nation, through one of the tribes, through one of the families, the seed of the woman will one day come into the world. But beginning with that statue, which is impressive, is the course of the nations. Listen, when no divinely appointed king of the tribe of Judah and the family of David is ruling over Israel, Israel is being ruled over by Babylon, by Medo-Persia, by Greece, by Rome. Boom, 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 boom. No Jewish king. And it's the Davidic king through which God is going to rule the world. And that Jewish king is the Messiah of Matthew 1:1. His birth. Wow! But they rejected him. So the Lord would say, you shall not see me henceforth until you will say at the end of time, blessed is you, comes the name of the Lord. What you have in Daniel chapter 2 is the course of the nations. Under Satan in an ultimate sense. Apart from God, idolatrous, unbelieving. Pick a nation, and I'll say to you, idolatrous, idolatrous, idolatrous. So here's this image, statue, colossus, head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, feet and toes of iron and clay, a mixture, composite. He's giving to us a course of history, beginning with the Babylonian captivity. Incidentally, Babylon came to town three times, 606 B.C., 598 B.C., and 586 B.C., three times. It's in 586 B.C., technically I would say that the times of the Gentiles begins, that's when he destroys the temple and stops any kind of Davidic rule with the kings. Last one, 586 B.C. Well, what is this dream? Is what Nebuchadnezzar says. And Daniel says, I'll tell you. There'll be four nations that will emerge. Head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs, the legs. And then in finality, the feet and toes. And if you look with me in your Bibles, at verse 31. Thou, O king, sawest, this is Daniel speaking to Nebuchadnezzar. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold a great image. Great in terms of impressive, awesome, but also fearful. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, magnificent, the idea is fearful, terrible, but impressive, humanly, great image, this great image whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass. Daniel's telling him what he dreamed. I'd like to have seen Nebuchadnezzar's face. He must have said, he's got it! Whoa! Whoa! How does he know this? All my advisors couldn't tell me anything. Verse 33, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon the feet, whereof iron and clay, and break them to pieces. Here is these nations, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. We'll say something about that in a moment. And then there's going to be a stone cut out of the mountain without hands. No human involvement. Perhaps even a reference to the virgin birth, deity. But it's a stone. Wow, how significant, a stone. Do you know the Bible refers to Christ as the smitten stone? For us, he is smitten and afflicted. Christ, a smitten stone. You know what Peter says? He says, for Israel, that stone, referring to Christ, was a stumbling stone. Peter will write concerning Israel. They stumbled at the stumbling stone unto which they were appointed. Divine sovereignty, human responsibility. They stumbled. But in sovereignty, they were appointed to that. There was divine sovereignty and human responsibility. Perfect illustration of it. They stumbled at the stumbling stone unto which they were appointed, being disobedient thereto. Stumbling stone. But you know what they are for you as believers? For the church? The chief cornerstone. Wow. But we should never forget he is also the smiting stone. Not simply the smitten stone. He is the smiting stone. He is going to smash this colossus of Gentile world powers on the feet, and the whole thing is coming tumbling down. Wow! This will happen during the day of the Lord. Connection with the second coming. The smiting stone will hit this colossus on the feet, and the whole thing will come tumbling down. Look at verse 35. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together. You know what that means? Very important. It means at the same time. At the same time. In connection with the second coming, the smiting stone is going to smite that colossus, that statue, that image on the feet, and the whole thing at the same time, together, is going to come tumbling down. Now I'm shouting. I'm emphasizing. I'm trying to communicate to you what you won't get in most commentaries. Some will say, oh, there was the Babylonian Empire. And then along came the Medes and the Persians. That was the end of the Babylonian Empire. And then came the Greeks. And they defeated the Persians. And now you have the Grecian Empire. That's the end of Persia. And then you have the Romans. And they do in the Greeks. And you have the Roman Empire. And then at the end you have, they usually would teach. That's got to be my wife calling me thinking I'm done. It's because I'm long-winded. It's your fault, Pastor. Never did that before. That's a first. It was my wife. She's off now. I love you, honey, but what'd you call me now for? Okay. Now listen. What I want to underscore for you, and I must end very quickly. Listen. There was the Babylonians, there were the Medo-Persians, there were the Greeks, there were the Romans. And then they say, and then there's the final empire of Rome. And that's going to be smitten on the feet, and that's going to be the end of Rome. No. The Babylonians were defeated, but that wasn't the end of Babylon. They continued on. They just weren't the superpower, but they continued. Just as Israel was scattered out of the land for 2,000 years, but they're still in Israel. And just as they come back and become dominant in the last day, so do the Babylonians. And the Persians were defeated by Babylon. The Persians defeated Babylon. But they are defeated by the Greeks. But Persia continues on. It was a third class country for centuries. But it wasn't the end of them. And they gave way to the Greeks, but that wasn't the end of it. When the stone cut out of the mountain without hands smites the Colossus on the feet, it all comes tumbling down together, the head, the chest and arms, the silver, the belly and thighs, the legs, it all comes down. It was all there at the end. Just as Israel came back, all of these nations would come back. Babylon? That's modern day Iraq. You hardly even knew what Iraq was and what part of the world it was in. It was in the last 20 years or so. Iraq, and we spent 9 years there. Fighting there. Many of our men died there. Thousands were wounded there. Tens of billions of dollars were spent there. And then because of politics, make no mistake about it, they pulled out our troops prematurely. And I'm telling you that because it has a lot to be with the end time events that is going to be in Iraq, but not the kind we had fought to establish. Medo-Persia. Persians changed their name in 1935. Persia was called Persia until 1935. And Persia changed its name from Persia to Iran in 1935. So when you're looking at that colossus, it's Iraq, it's Iran. Third, I said to you, Greece, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, historically. And so when I say Greece, you say, oh, Mesopotamia. Ah, you say, oh, Europe, that's where Greece is, Europe. Bankrupt, but that's where it's at in Europe. It's not what it's talking about. Greece, prophetically, historically, biblically, accurately, is Syria. Look, Alexander the Great, somewhere around 320 BC, something in there, pretty close. He ruled over the city-states that became known as Greece in Europe. Macedonia. With a small army, he crossed the Aegean Sea from Europe, crossed a narrow body of water where he crossed the Aegean Sea, into Asia Minor, into Persia, and began to fight the Persians. And he fought them for about 11 or 12 years. Not only the Persians, Alexander the Great with an army, historians tell us, of maybe 50,000 men. Well trained, dedicated. Went to fight the Persian army, which historians tell us was more than 1 million in number. But Alexander the Great was one of the greatest generals of all time. He chooses the battles, the sites, the time, hits them and runs, hits them and disappears, chooses when, how, goes all the way east to India and all the way south to Egypt and everything in between. What's the language of the New Testament? Original. Greek. Why? Because Alexander the Great took Aristotle with him, took his philosophers with him, took his educators with him, and spread the Greek culture, the Greek language, the Greek dress, the Greek gods. As he conquered, they educated the Greek language, the Greek gods, the Greek philosophy, the Greek dress, the Greek love for the gymnasium. It was called Hellenism. It has nothing to do with hell as a location, but it means the Greek culture. He captured it all. He never got back to Europe. He never got back to Macedonia. He just fighting until about 32-ish, I think, he died. And when he died, he had no heirs, so the Greek Empire was divided up into four of his generals. And one of them took over the area of Egypt. The other took the area of Greater Syria, east, what was known as, used to be known as Assyria. One of it was the Ptolemies. Ptolemy was one of the four generals of Alexander the Great. Was all part of the Grecian Empire. One of them was Syria. And it was Syria where Antiochus Epiphanes of Syria attacked Jerusalem. He is the one that desecrated the temple, offered a pig as a sacrifice to his pagan god Zeus, and paraded in a picture of Zeus with his face on it into the Holy of Holies. It was the abomination of desolation, which the Lord is referring to in the Olivet Discourse. When you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. Syria was part of the Grecian Empire. The fourth one, they say Rome. Yeah, Rome. The legs, feet, the toes at the end. Rome. And so everybody says, oh yeah, Western Europe. Rome, Italy. Oh, my professors got all excited when the common market started. They would say, oh, it's going to be 10. That'll be the 10 toes. And then it was the European Union, and it expanded until it was 27. Oops, we got a little problem here. How are we going to have the 10 toes or the 10 horns? But the Roman Empire was not only in Western Europe. It included Iraq, Iran, Syria, listen carefully, and Turkey. That was all part of the Roman Empire, not just Italy. As a martyr, matter of fact, part of the Roman Empire was governed from Constantinople in Turkey for an extended period of time. There was the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire. Everybody goes west, but the Bible is going east. What I'm trying to say to you, because I was supposed to say something about what's going on in Israel today. You got Iraq? We pulled out of there, and Iran's already taking it over. Iran? That's the number one problem in the world today. Iran. Who in the world is going to stop Iran from getting atomic bombs? Because the rulers of Iran are nuts. They're the worst kind of zealots. They're theological zealots. And they want to destroy Israel first and Christianity second and rule the world. The biggest concern, I don't know if you know, you've really got the straight scoop, but President Obama had went to Israel and said, let's have the largest cooperative military exercise that has ever been carried on between the Israeli military and the American military, and it was all moving ahead. I think it was to occur in March. And recently, you didn't hear this in the news, but it was the Prime Minister of Israel, shocking our administration and the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to the shock of our president and our government, he canceled it. Not America, as you may hear, Israel. Because Israel was dismayed and concerned because our administration has backed away from the strong attempt to keep Iran from getting the atomic bomb. And one of the things was to close the central banking of Iran, and we backed away from it. And Turkey, that was Eastern Rome. That was where Rome was controlled from, Constantinople. Rome. It was pro-Israel. It was one of Israel's best allies worldwide. Here was a Muslim country in the Middle East, was very close to Israel. You ask any Israeli, where do you want to go on vacation? Oh, Turkey. Wonderful place to go. They provided the water that Israel had purchased from Turkey. They had fantastic relationships up until about 10 years ago. And the reason for that you could have this great relationship for about 50 years earlier, the Turkish government had said, we will have a civil government. We will not allow Islam to control our government. It was the only Middle Eastern country. And so they had wonderful relations with Israel. And then they got a president about 10 years ago. He is a fanatical anti-Semite. He hates Israel. And everything has changed. And what you're moving toward is that colossus with the head of gold, the chest and arms of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, the legs of iron. It's off the front page of your newspapers. I didn't make it up. I didn't force it to fit. It is there. Iraq. Iran. Syria. Turkey. They all have to come back because a stone is going to smite it on the feet. And it's all going to come tumbling down. It's what leading us toward the seventh week of the book of Daniel, what is commonly, I would say erroneously, called the tribulation period, because the whole 7 years is not the tribulation period. One of the questions that I can't answer for you is this conflict going to start before the 70th week or inside of that 70th week? I always felt that it would be toward the latter part of that 70th week, part of the campaign of Armageddon. But the more I'm studying, the more I'm looking, the more I'm praying, the more I'm not convinced. But I can tell you as I close, things of dramatic prophetic significance is happening before your very eyes. It wasn't happening 20 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 200 years ago or 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 1,500 years ago. It is happening now before your eyes. I think what's happening in America with regard to our national debt, our unemployment, other moral breakdown, all the things that are happening, all is playing a part into it, because if we are losing our superpower status, we cannot stop a lot of those things which we normally would have been stopping going on in the Middle East, because we don't have the power or the money to do it right now. It's impacting the whole world. That's the reason Western Europe is bankrupt. The European currency may go kaput altogether. These are crucial hours of history. And only the believer has the potential, because most aren't getting it from the pulpit, of knowing what is really going on, what the prophetic word has to say And I can't set a date for the end of the age, but I will tell you that I'm 76, and I live with the totality of my being. I live with the expectation that I can certainly live until the rapture of the church, the second coming of Christ. We are getting close. This is not a time for tiptoeing through the tulips. We must be living in the power of God and for the glory of God while it is day, because the night will soon come when no one can work. Some of our magazines are available somewhere. As long as they last, pick up a copy, and we'd be glad to send you a complimentary subscription if you want to know more about these things. Thank you so much, and the Lord bless you.